The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. For the most comprehensive industry news and information, visit our website at irei.com and sign up for our free daily news alerts.
This podcast has been sponsored by Juniper Square. Juniper Square is transforming the private capital markets industry with solutions and services that streamline fundraising, investment operations, and investor reporting. Designed for commercial real estate, Juniper Square is trusted by hundreds of investment sponsors to manage more than $1 trillion in real estate investments. Reach Juniper Square at junipersquare.com.
This is Mike Consul. As always, thank you for joining us. You're about to hear from Tom Arnold of McKinsey & Company. He is also former global head of real estate for the Abu Dhabi Investment Authority, one of the big sovereign wealth funds in the world. And he's been involved in the real estate business in one capacity or another for a very long time. Tom Arnold recently did a study along with his co-researchers, David Ling and Andy Naraho of the University of Florida, to answer the perennial question, which type of real estate outperforms the other, public or private real estate? The study was sponsored by NAREIT, the National Association of Real Estate Investment Trusts. During the following conversation, you'll hear Tom Arnold talk about the research and the meticulous considerations involved in the research effort to make sure that the methodology was relevant and accurate. Then he gets into the actual results of that survey. To read the full research, go to the NAREIT website at reit.com, R-E-I-T.com. From the homepage, navigate your way to the research page and you will be able to access the information from there. I think you'll find this discussion interesting and enlightening. So without further delay, here is my conversation with Tom Arnold of McKinsey & Company. When you were at Abu Dhabi Sovereign Wealth Fund, what percentage of the real estate sleeve was private versus public?
Well, it was predominantly private.
What does that tell you?
It tells me that their orientation was gaining exposure to real estate markets through private vehicles.
Okay, but so let's get to NAREIT. You did this research on behalf of NAREIT. You know, NAREIT's got a different perspective than, say, the people who are doing private placements and such, using private equity for real estate investing, directly investing in real estate. There is the whole argument about the illiquidity premium. But your research found something a little bit different. What did your research find between public and private real estate investing? And let's be clear, public is publicly traded REITs, correct? Or are there some other elements to it?
Yes, we looked at as measures for the public market, something that was investable, which is either the U.S. REIT index or the developed market global REIT index. So that was the public standard, if you will. Now, I think what was unique about our research is that historically, a lot of the research has focused on a kind of a synthetic private average of some kind. And that is to say, it wouldn't have been anything that's investable. In other words, there's no index that you can invest in that puts you in every real estate private equity fund or even every real estate private equity fund by vintage. So the question is, are you really making an apples to apples comparison? And so the reason that I talked a little bit about our prior research is that this really was an extension. I mean, when we looked at the prior research, we were looking at the first volume of research was focused on the nature of private fund investing. And that is kind of the fact that you have to maintain capital for capital calls. You don't know exactly when your capital will be called. And so you have an uncertain start of your investment horizon. You have an investment horizon of an uncertain length. There may be, cost of maintaining liquidity for those capital calls. You don't really have any control over the leverage that's in those vehicles, and they tend not to be very liquid at the end of the day. Now, having said that, they're presumably you're being compensated for that based on the skill of the manager and the uniqueness of the access to deal flow and things of that nature. We were looking at questions like, do big funds outperform small funds? Is the speed of the growth of a fund, does that change its performance? How significant is vintage volume? Do domestic funds outperform international funds, and so on? So the questions were really objective questions and questions that were interesting to us. Now, fast forward to this most recent research, we weren't trying to solve for a particular result. I mean, this was academic research, and what we thought was that there really hadn't been a good precedent for the appropriate comparison. Because from prior findings, we know that in the private markets, vintage volume is extremely important. In other words, if you invest in a fund, a 2017 fund, you really need to compare that with other 2017 funds, not against funds of any vintage. And sure, the performance tends to be inversely related to the ease of capital raising. So in vintage years when managers raise a lot of capital, those funds tend to underperform the counterfactual. That is, when there's little money raised, when it's difficult for managers to raise, those that do raise tend to outperform, you know, kind of other vintages. So one of the keys is that you've got to make sure that you're comparing in some way the appropriate vintages with each other. Those vintages are influenced by, the GDP, the growth of the GDP, the underlying interest rate, the credit spreads. There are a number of macroeconomic influences on those things. So what we did was design kind of what we informally referred to as the horse race. And so we looked at a large set of funds. We started with 950, but we whittled it down to 375 U.S. domestic funds and 255 international funds. And we had, before those funds, we knew the net IRR distributed to their investors. We knew their net equity multiple. We knew the quarter in which they became 25%, 50%, and 75% called. So we had an indicator in terms of the speed of deployment. And so with that information, we ran a mathematical equivalency to equate a net IRR and net equity multiple, which creates a period of time. And that period of time is the investment horizon. So it's effectively like taking the 10 or 12 capital calls that an investor makes in a fund and collapsing them into one point in time as the start of your investment horizon. And if there's 6 or 8 or 15 distributions from the fund, those are all collapsed into effectively a single distribution. And then the distance between the starting point and the ending point is the length of the investment horizon. And that can be determined precisely and mathematically. Then the question is, when did that fund start? And again, we had 3 different potential start points, which was when the fund was 25% called, or 50 or 75. We ran all 3, and it turned out that it really didn't impact the results. So we settled on 50% called. So in other words, if we know a fund had an investment horizon of, well, I'll use easy math, 16 quarters, exactly 4 years, and that we know that in 2013, in the third quarter, it was 50% called, then we had an investment horizon from the third quarter of 2013 to the appropriate quarter, that is the second quarter, 2017. Now, why does this matter? Why are we worrying about the calendar so much? Well, again, it's to appropriately calibrate for the macroeconomic conditions and make sure we're matching up the right time periods and the vintage effects. So then what we did was we took a look at that fund and we as an alternative said, rather than investing that money for 16 quarters at the third quarter of 2013 start date, what if you put that capital in a REIT index? And then what if you pulled the distribution out in the second quarter of 2017? So we created a stylized public market equivalent. And so with that, we compared each of the 375 domestic funds and each of the 255 international funds to the appropriate index, be it domestic or foreign, for the exact time period of the fund.
Well, look, there's, you know, let me talk about some of these variables that you mentioned. There's big funds versus small funds, but there's also early funds such as, you know, the first and second funds that an organization will put out there tend to perform better than funds number 4, 5, and 6, because by then they're kind of fat and happy on their fees. So if they're young funds, first, second in particular, and I guess maybe third, then you talk about investment horizon. So now I start to think in terms of institutional investors versus individual investors. Individual investors obviously have shorter time horizons. They have greater need for liquidity. They tend not to be, not have patient capital. If you think about Abu Dhabi, I mean, there's a, basically a time horizon is infinity. You know, we're going to, if we're going to invest money in private real estate, directly invest in private real estate, it might be a 25-year program we're thinking in terms of. Your average individual would not be thinking in those terms. So what about those factors as well? I mean, because if you're an institutional investor, it's kind of like, you know, if I'm ready to just invest money and sit for 25 years on private real estate, how would it do over that term versus public REITs? And I suspect that's one of the reasons why Abu Dhabi was mostly, the sovereign wealth fund was mostly in private real estate. So what about some of these factors?
Well, let's touch on, you mentioned several, and let's talk about them. I mean, what we were comparing in this particular study was closed-end private equity real estate funds. These are finite life vehicles that typically will call capital either over a 3 or 4 year period. The capital stays invested typically for 3 or 4 years. It takes a window of time to liquidate the funds and distribute it. So you probably have, you know, on average, a 10-year relationship in a particular vehicle with a manager where you've at least contributed, you know, you made your first capital call and you have not yet received your, you know, your last capital call. That can run 8, 9, 10 years, and sometimes it can run much longer. But your capital is only at work 3 or 4 years inside of that 8, 9, 10 year window. So I would suggest that if you had an investor who was looking for a constant 25-year exposure, whatever the length of time is, but if it's something significantly more than, you know, 5 or 10 years, that a closed-end private equity fund would not necessarily be the way to go. I mean, there are a lot of, you know, a lot of frictions in and a lot of frictions out of these funds. You said something else that I have not identified in the research, and I will go back and look at it in the sense that we did not find young funds to outperform more seasoned managers. And the analysis is, the design and the theory of the experiment is extremely sensitive. For example, when we were checking whether large funds or small funds outperformed one another, we split it in two, and we took the half that were above the median and half that were below the median. and the larger funds outperform the smaller funds, splitting it two ways. Then we split it three ways, and we took a third, a third, a third, and we took small, medium, and large. And the medium funds were the highest performer, then the large funds, then the small funds. Then we did it one more time, and we took it 30, 30, 30, and 10. So we took the 30% smallest funds, the 30% medium-sized funds, the 30% largest funds, and then the 10% mega funds. These are the 5, 10, $15 billion funds. And in fact, the most significant performers were those mega funds. It was the 10%. So the way you design your experiment, I could have said it's the large funds. No, it's the medium funds. No, it's the mega funds, depending on, you know, kind of how you sort it. So running robustness checks on this is quite important. We did find in our second paper persistence. So in other words, there is some indication that the quartile performance of a real estate private equity fund is influenced by the actual performance of the immediate prior fund. So that sounds like good news. It's not quite as good as it sounds, in the sense that if there is a fund one that performs really well, and let's say it's a top quartile fund, and then they come to raise a second fund, that if you look back on this with 5 to 10 years of hindsight, you'll find that if they were a top quartile performer in fund one, that they're likely to overperform in fund two. And by overperform, I mean it's a non-random likelihood of being in each of the quartiles, that they would be probably still in the first quartile and at least probably in the top two quartiles. Now, here's the catch. When the fund managers come to raise money from you for fund two, you actually don't know yet what the performance of fund one is. I mean, it's an academic consideration, but, you know, it's 7 years down the road before you really know how fund one did. And they're knocking on your door 3 years after they raised fund one. So saying there's a relationship between fund one and fund two is not helpful for investment managers or retail investors that are having to make decisions about those funds. There is some slight persistence by the third fund. So there is a little bit of guidance, but it decays pretty quickly. So the informational value is not early enough for you to really act on it.
Well, the research done on early funds outperforming, that's from consulting firms like Townsend and Cortland. Just FYI, that's where I pull that from. So why does public real estate outperform private real estate?
Well, our research showed that there was, without any sort of risk adjustments, that 53% of the time you would have been better off in the public markets, investing in the REIT index, than with the manager. And 47% of the time, again, without risk adjustments, you would have been better off investing in a private equity real estate fund. So, I mean, they're certainly very, very different industries, because although they both invest in real estate, there is a lot of regulation and there's a lot of pressure on the public managers to be quite transparent about what they're doing and their debt levels and everything about their operations, both the opportunities and the risk. The private managers are, it's a little more oblique in the sense that it can be very difficult. I mean, I will say for the, you know, fans of private managers, that if you believe you can identify a top quartile manager, you should go with it. That's great. But the question is, what is the ability? I mean, I know investors that are in 100 funds with 75 different managers, I would argue that that's really, you know, almost a beta exposure, because you're in so many managers across so many, you know, so many different strategies that it begins to kind of wash itself out, and the opportunity for alpha kind of begins to cancel itself out. And then when we get there, we can talk about, you know, are there risk premia that should be awarded or earned by private investors for challenges that they have to endure that public investors don't?
What was the difference between public performance and private performance in your study? What is the differentiation? Divide.
It was on average about 165 basis points domestically. It was almost 200 basis points, 194 basis points internationally. But what you find...
Now, what...
Go ahead. Sorry.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say that, you know, my basic premise is you have to be very careful with averages, because the distribution is so much more important than an average. You need to sort it out. You need to kind of spread it across the table and really see the results. So, you know, taking the outperformance of the 53% and say, okay, well, sometimes it's 10 basis points and sometimes it's, you know, 8 percentage points. And what does that average look like? Well, it averages 165 basis points. But again, it would have been almost impossible to experience, you know, 165 basis points of outperformance relative to a particular fund. I mean, so we're kind of, you know, those averages, I think, always have to be taken with caution. I think the point is that there was greater than 50% of the time you would have been better off in the public markets, and the outperformance is material. You know, it's not 10 basis points or something that is marginal. Most of the time, it's significant enough, certainly well over a percentage point of outperformance. And then I don't mean to get you ahead, but when you're ready, we did the same analysis thinking about a potential illiquidity premium, a potential for the variation in leverage between the private fund managers and the public markets, and then you know, an opportunity cost, which is a complicated topic of itself, in maintaining dry capital for not knowing when you were going to make the investment.
You know, what about the person who says, well, this is a rearview mirror study, you're looking back, and you're looking at a stock market that has had a historic performance. And most experts say going forward, it's not going to be like this. Okay, we're not going to, stock market is not going to increase by another 10,000% over the next 25 years. We're going to have to be looking at a more diverse portfolio. We're going to have to hedge against things like inflation. We're going to have to be thinking in terms of hard assets. And publicly traded REITs are going to go down with the market. It doesn't matter that the real estate's still as solid as it ever was, or that it's being managed marvelously. It's going to go down because it just follows all the equities downstream, down to the bottom. And you're stuck there. So what do you say to that person who's saying it's a rearview mirror study, but going forward, it's not supposed to play this way? And never mind that real estate is as sound as ever. It's being treated like an equity, not like a real estate fund.
Well, I guess my point of view is that the public and private markets can look very, very different over short periods of time and look very similar to one another over extended periods of time. So, you know, you ask a question early on about, you know, the potential for an impatient retail investor versus a sovereign, for example, that might have patience that's measured in decades, that type of thing. So I guess I'm not quite willing to accept that with a sufficiently long enough period that public real estate will simply reflect the overall market conditions of the equity markets and will not reflect inherent and fundamental value of the underlying real estate. I mean, if the public markets went as you suggested, and the REITs went as you suggested, I could only accept that probability if I thought real estate values, direct hard asset values, were falling as well. It's difficult for me to envision a world where hard asset real estate values are increasing consistently and the value of REITs continues to decline and decline and decline.
Or let's say the stock market simply slides sideways. It's just, hey, it's you're going to squeeze out a percent or two of gain, but it's not what people need, what people want, or what people need. What you're saying then, Tom, is that ultimately the equities that have solid fundamentals are going to rise. They're going to do better than the overall market is, I think, yes. What I hear you saying.
Yes.
Okay, so what's the takeaway here? What's the takeaway from the report or takeaways? What are the you know, give me a bullet point or two or three that you think are the real most salient points from that report?
Well, you've asked some great questions, and there's certainly a lot of, you know, practical application. I mean, what does this really mean? What do we do with it? So what you kind of implied, which I completely agree with, is we continue to have to exist in a low return environment. And so, you know, what do we expect corporate profits to look like in the corporate world? What do we think will happen to real estate values? What do we think will happen with, you know, the cost of debt, all of those type of things? And certainly one has to begin with a point of view on that. The reason I'm bringing that up is that the private equity real estate vehicles are great opportunities to gain exposure to outstanding managers who are highly incentivized, you know, financially and otherwise, to try to find, you know, unique investment opportunities that will generate a lot of alpha. And, you know, in some ways, we've seen the development of the public equities market do that. I mean, the advent of, you know, it used to be, you know, what did real estate used to be? It used to be office, industrial, retail, and multifamily. And, you know, what is it today? It includes data centers and cell towers and life sciences and, you know, all these things. And in the housing, it's no longer just limited to apartments. There's single family for rent and there's senior housing and there's student housing and, you know, and on and on. So there has been a tremendous proliferation both in the public and private space. And so I think the interesting thing is to take a look at, you know, what's your belief in terms of the sectors that you think are going to be attractive? You know, it wasn't that long ago that malls and center city hotels were the darling of the real estate investment world. Well, that has certainly changed, and it can be very, very difficult for private investors to, you know, to sell large regional malls, for example, or a huge convention center hotel and those type of exposures. You know, you may not like the pricing in the public market, but if you said, look, tomorrow is going to be worse than today, you do have you can create a liquidity event. And so I think the takeaway is that there is a place for public real estate investment in any portfolio that's considering real estate. It should not displace private, but it should be a complement to, and you should take a look at the modes of access that are available to you and make a decision for each type of exposure that you'd like to have. I mean, institutions, almost all institutions, 80 to 90% of all institutions use these closed-end funds for their private equity investment. It's the most popular. And then the least popular are just the direct and even the separate accounts, at least for the smaller investors. And what we've seen a lot of growth of, something that's been big in Europe, that's now becoming much larger in the U.S. are the open-ended core funds and core plus funds. So the question is, what type of real estate exposure is most attractive to you, and what's the most efficient way to get there? And there will be certainly situations you may decide you want life science exposure. And, you know, maybe NAREIT would suggest, well, look at Alexandria, and you say, no, I don't want it across the U.S. I want it only in the Boston area. Well, that's not available to the public market. So that might be, you know, a great candidate to either have a separate account or to focus on a manager that's got expertise and unique access to something that either geographically or sector specific and targeted. So it's just, just where I started in my last role as a CIO. The public securities were almost an afterthought, and there's a lot that can be done with it. I mean, we ended up looking at many, many managers. We spent a ton of time with 34. We could use them. You know, one of the interesting ways to use the public markets as a completion strategy. If you want to do it privately and you want to set up a development platform to whatever exposure you may want, let's say it's to build cell towers or data centers. Well, it might take you a couple of years to put all that together, you know, to negotiate the documents, to find the right partner, to get the legal structures set up and to begin, you know, finding the deals. There's nothing to prevent you from investing in a data center REIT in the interim and then fund your private investment through an ultimate sale of that exposure. I mean, you can pick up the exposure as you need it, as opposed to taking the time that it often takes to build it out.
How will the research be used by NAREIT? We have Ron. Maybe we should bring Ron in here. There you are, Ron. How is NAREIT going to use this? So this is Ron Kuykendall from NAREIT. Ron, how will NAREIT use the research?
NAREIT, from time to time, does sponsor outside research in addition to doing it ourselves. And we use it to support our investor outreach program. NAREIT has a staff of economists and investor outreach people who are essentially investor relations people who are our face to the investment community. We have a group of people who specifically deal with the large institutional community, with pension funds, family offices, and so forth. And our approach in our investor outreach strives to be a research-based approach. You know, we're not presenting opinion. We're presenting the best thinking of solid researchers and solid research. And we present ourselves to investors, you know, as a resource. You know, we're not salespeople. We're people who come in, provide resources, and help them, you know, get to answers.
I think, the answer is in the eye of the beholder. You know, when we were researching and trying to determine, you know, the cost of liquidity or illiquidity to investors, the answer is that there is not one answer to that. It really is idiosyncratic to the position of an investor and, you know, where they are in their life cycle. Are they investing in other vehicles? Are they getting distributions that are offsetting required capital calls and all that, all the things that, you know, that you might think. I guess the one thing that that was kind of interesting is that, you know, this wasn't, you know, 90-10. This wasn't that public real estate's completely blew private out of the water. It's just that, you know, more often than not, in most vehicles, and again, this was 2000 vintage, and 01 and 02 and 03 and 04 and 05 and 06 and 07. So this is, you know, 15 years of vintages. So it's, I think it's somewhat insulated from the idea, oh, we've just had a big run in the stock market, because we're trying to account for that by by the vintage year as a fixed effect. But I guess the biggest aha moment is that you would presume that you would get an illiquidity premium if you invested in something that you didn't know when you could get your money back. And even when the private vehicles outperform the public vehicles, there's no indication that you're really getting an illiquidity premium for investing through the private markets. And it's the single, you know, the two reasons you hear most frequently why people are investing through the private markets are for diversification away from public equities and the illiquidity premium that they assume is a, you know, inherent right, which we did not find.
So even if it outperformed, you're saying that then you have to subtract out fees, the fees that are associated with it. And in the end, you really haven't made out any better. There is no premium there. The premium was not there.
Right. If you gave me the exact same returns, and let's simplify it and say over a similar risk horizon, because the research that I teach a real estate class at a university, and you know what I told my students based on NCREIF and NAREIT research was that over the last 20 years, that at a gross level, that public and private real estate have performed virtually on top of each other. The difference is that the public real estate had significantly higher standard deviation, almost like 3x. So, you know, you can do research and you can take a start and stop period over 20 years and you can say, hey, there's really not much difference. But that's kind of artificial because you can't invest in NCREIF as an index. So when you're pretending that you can invest in something that's uninvestable, what can you invest in? You could do that work with any single Odyssey fund. You could do that work with any closed-end fund. You could make any combination of those funds that you choose to. Let me just share some results from our first work. When we were trying to figure out how we thought closed-end private equity real estate funds had performed, we came up with a number, and it was 8.2. And that was a simple average. I was just taking every fund in our sample, adding up the returns and dividing by the number in the sample. Then we did a market weight, a capital weight, and this won't surprise you given what I told you what the mega funds do, but it added 110 basis points to the average return. So on a capital weighted, market weighted basis, private equity real estate funds did even better. So that's where the fund manager stopped the conversation. But we went one step further and we said, what if we dollar duration weighted? So in other words, you put your money in day one in every fund that was available to you day one, and you got the money back whenever they sent it back to you. How'd you do? And over that same time period, it dropped from 9.3 to 4.6%. It cut in half. And I said, we have a mathematical problem. Went back in and I was looking at the work, lost sleep over it a couple of nights, and then split it by quartile and figured out that the winners, the top quartile managers, keep your capital at work less than a third the length of time that the bottom quartile managers. So the losers keep your money forever and the winners get it back to you quickly. And so when you do it that way, and it's consistent with my experience in the industry, because the bottom quartile are generally somewhere around, you know, breaking even and losing some money. And the conduct of managers who get below, if they're showing a NAV and a net asset value in the portfolio that's less than your investment, they will keep your money to the end of time. And their objective is to try to do whatever it takes to nominally get you back to 1-0. So they can say, well, we may have had your capital for 12 years, but you didn't lose any money with us. You got a 1.0 equity multiple. But, you know, when we were making 10 and 12% annual IRRs and we had some manager that's earning back, you know, digging themselves out of a hole and making 4% or 5%, I explained to them that the opportunity cost of them keeping the money is what we would have been making on that money had they given it back to us, and that we did not want them to wait until they could give us a 1.0 equity multiple. We would be more than happy with a 0.8 and let us do our work. But most people don't, most investors don't approach it that way. So, you know, when you're looking at the public markets, you generally either think about equal weighted or market weighted. It's only two ways to think about it, I think, or you can take out, you know, subsectors. And if you do that in the private market, you're missing something very important, because, you know, our fund set that we analyzed in 2017, over an 8% net-net to investors, over 9% net-net to investors on a market-weighted basis. But the real experience of investors was sub 5%. Why? Because the durations aren't the same. And you don't need to worry about that in the public market, because you can go and come as you please. But in the private markets, you don't have that right. And so we're mispricing, if you will, the uncertainty surrounding the return of your capital in the private markets. And it's highly related to performance. And the worse the performance, the longer the managers keep your capital.
So if listeners want to get a copy of this research, how do they do that?
This most recent work that we're talking about is going to be published in the Journal of Portfolio Management. I think it's October is the official date. There is a link, Ron, and I think that's available to the public, the digital publication, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. There is a link to the Journal of Portfolio Management piece in full that is on our website, REIT.com, and then go to the research section.
And the other two papers, some of this data that I talked about, Mike, is in the prior two papers. So there's a 2017 and a 2019 paper cited in this article that we're talking about. Same authors, Arnold, Ling, and Arano. And so this is, you know, kind of, this is chapter three of at least a 4 or 5 chapter book. There's another piece coming behind it.
This podcast has been sponsored by Juniper Square. Juniper Square is transforming the private capital markets industry with solutions and services that streamline fundraising, investment operations, and investor reporting. Designed for commercial real estate, Juniper Square is trusted by hundreds of investment sponsors to manage more than $1 trillion in real estate investments. Reach Juniper Square at junipersquare.com.